Welcome to an Atos podcast.
Welcome back to the Atos Healthcare and Life Sciences Digital Transformation Series, where we discuss the current trends and prominent issues in the industry. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with John Bamford, Head of Advisory EcoAct in the UK, which is an Atos-owned company, and Lauren Sugden, who is the Global Head of Decarbonisation and Sustainability within the healthcare and life sciences industry. John has been working at EcoAct since 2016 and has experience in helping companies understand their climate impact, but also supporting them on their journey to net zero through energy efficiency and reducing emissions. Lauren has been at Atos since 2018 and is passionate about supporting clients understand not only the effects of climate change, but also the risk climate change will bring if action is not taken now, as well as understanding the opportunity the climate crisis can bring when it comes to growth, competitive advantage, and cost savings for the organisations. Lauren also shares a passion for sustainability in her personal life and loves to grow her own fruit and vegetables in her own allotment. Welcome, John and Lauren. It's clear to see that you're both incredibly passionate about both decarbonisation and sustainability, and I'm really keen to understand the reasons as to why this is such an interest to you both.
Thank you for inviting me to be a part of this series. It's really great to be here today. So I feel like the words decarbonisation and sustainability are such buzzwords nowadays. There's a lot of talk around the subject of the future of our planet, but very little concrete action taking place. So whether we're talking about large NGOs or more at a localised personal level in our daily lives, we should be significantly ahead of where we are when it comes to meeting the needs of the present without compromising the future generation's ability to meet their needs, as well as reducing carbon emission production in the atmosphere. The climate crisis isn't about to happen. For me, it's already here, and I think a lot of us know that. It's already arrived. The world's already heated up to 1.1 degree since pre-industrial eras. With an ambition in line with the Paris Agreement set in 2015 to limit global temperature rise to well below 2 degrees, with an aspiration to keep it at 1.5, we all must act urgently now to be able to achieve such ambitious targets. So we're currently on a catastrophic path, with the president of the Maldives as a classic example stating that if we're not to reach the targets set in line with the Paris Agreement, the difference between 1.5 to 2 degrees is a death sentence for Ireland. And unfortunately, I'm sure this is the same for many others as well. I'm passionate not only about playing a role, as you've kind of said, within my work life, but also my personal life as well, to be more sustainable and reduce my own carbon footprint, such as the love for my homegrown produce down at my local allotment, but also to make public and private sector organisations globally aware of not only the threat that climate change has brought and is continuing to bring, and for them to understand their responsibility to act, but also to understand the opportunity as well that the climate crisis can bring beyond reducing CO2 emissions. As I've kind of said already, the climate crisis is no longer something that we can choose to really engage in. It's a topic that there's no longer a choice. It's kind of mandatory now for everyone. And no matter how large or small, we all need to make a difference to start saving our planet for future generations.
I couldn't agree more. And doing what we can to help now is so important for that future generation, as the climate crisis will only continue to worsen. And how about you, John? What does decarbonisation and sustainability mean to you?
Hi, Mish and Lauren. Thank you very much for having me here today. So in answer to your question, from an early age, I've been fascinated by nature and the environment. I was lucky enough to have access to the countryside as my grandparents and cousins were farmers. So I experienced a lot of the conservation efforts that they adopted into their land management practices. Also, my dad was a keen twitcher or bird spotter, so he would often have his binoculars out on walks and on holidays pointing out the different species. So this appreciation of the environment was again reignited during my engineering degree, where one of the modules we covered was environmental science. This in turn led me towards a career in what's called building services, where I was able to design efficient energy systems for new buildings. These experiences led me to understand the link between human activity and the damage that we were causing through our dependency on carbon emissions. Throughout my career, it's taken a number of minor twists and turns, but all in the same related area. So for the past 20 years or so, I've had this on my mind, and this sort of carbon conscience can weigh quite heavily. Finally, the world is waking up though, but the challenge is even greater now than it was before, and really time is not on our side. the extreme climate change events that were previously predicted, yet still denied by a few skeptics, occurs more frequently now and much more on our doorsteps. The impact of these for future generations is pretty scary. It will only get worse before it gets better, and the fallout felt much wider in our societies. So bringing this back to a personal perspective as to why, I have two young children, and unsurprisingly, I want them to enjoy a world as it is now, or at least as how I have seen it. And I don't think that that will be possible without taking this topic seriously and also being really passionate about making a difference.
I'm really interested to understand why decarbonisation sustainability is an agenda priority in today's world.
So moving potentially in response to that question into a bit more sort of technical areas, the scientific consensus is really clear. In order to avoid catastrophic climate change, as depicted in the post-Paris IPCC's report, we need to limit our global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels. Today, we're already at about the 1.1, 1.2 degrees centigrade and really feeling the effects, meaning that the window for achieving our target and avoiding the most catastrophic impacts is rapidly closing. The global community, in terms of responding to it, have came up with the Paris Accord, but the progress against this accord is very much falling short. Collectively, we're all responsible for the impacts that we have on the planet, and it's vital that as a global community, we move urgently beyond low carbon to no carbon. That position of no carbon is actually termed as net zero. Now, this is the state where no incremental greenhouse gases are added to the atmosphere. And essentially what this requires is a clear understanding of emissions that we are producing. And this is done through the measurement of a carbon footprint. And the next step is really to reduce our emissions considerably, making sure that the emissions output is actually closer to zero, as close to zero as possible. And then also consistent with the warming scenarios that have been outlined around 1.5 degrees. And then the final aspect of that is really to offset or neutralize any of the remaining emissions via removing them from the atmosphere. So taking those emissions, sequestering them from the atmosphere and making sure that they are permanently removed. Now, the second point that I mentioned there is the drastic reduction in carbon emissions is the clear cornerstone for attaining net zero. And this is where the term decarbonisation comes into play. We have such an intrinsic link with carbon in every walks of life that what we need to do in order to reach and reduce that carbon emissions is to drastically remove them from the all walks of life. So that whether that be in our housing, the construction of it or the energy associated with our housing, the food supply chains, whether that be from the growing of the food through to the logistics behind getting it into our fridges and freezers. And then also with our just products and consumables that we are attached to in a day-by-day basis. So as you can see, it really is a top priority to take action at all levels, that individual, business, governmental levels in order to hit these goals. The private and the public sector are really pivotal to this change and need to act. And if not, essentially not decarbonize, they will be pushed through government commitments to net zero, which ultimately are being translated into law as we speak. And for those businesses that do not act and do nothing, they will essentially also lose their licenses to operate.
Thanks, John. Lauren, I was really shocked to hear that the direct damage to the healthcare industry due to climate change will be between 2 to 4 billion every year by 2030. It's clear to see that the industry needs to act. Why? But kind of taking that previous statistic into consideration, why is this so urgent and what is the importance within the healthcare industry?
So firstly, I agree that stat which you just read out is really truly shocking. An even more shocking stat to me actually is that healthcare makes up 4.4% of global greenhouse gas emissions every single year. So if the healthcare sector was a planet, it would be the fifth largest emitter globally. And the top 10 healthcare emitters actually make up 75% of the global healthcare climate footprint, which was just shocking for me to find out. So it's been said that obviously climate change is damaging to human health today and will have an even greater impact in the future. And the World Health Organization has actually estimated that between 2030 to 2050 alone, climate change is expected to cause approximately 250,000 additional deaths per year from malnutrition, malaria, diarrhea, and heat stress. So to me, it's clear to see that climate change is the biggest global health threat of the 21st century. The global healthcare industry will experience significant and growing impacts from climate change, just like they already are, with the best way of viewing this kind of broken down into four main categories, which I'm sure we're all aware of and think of when it comes to climate change. So these include extreme weather, rising temperatures, rising sea levels, and increasing CO2 levels. So I'm just going to talk about two of these ever so briefly, otherwise you'll find me talking about this forever. So the first area I want to speak about was the rising temperatures. So obviously through the increase of extreme heat and severe weather events, we're seeing higher mental health impacts, unfortunately, heat-related illness and death, as well as cardiovascular failure. A clear example of the impacts of rising temperature and the impact it's having right now can sadly be seen in Africa, where one in every five people face hunger in 2020, with 282 million people in the whole of Africa facing hunger, which is more than double the proportion of any other region worldwide. And unfortunately, these conditions are only deteriorating, with 7.2 million people at risk of starvation and 12.8 million children malnourished. So the climate challenges are increasing, the pressures on the healthcare system are increasing, and inevitably they're going to bear a higher cost. Poor health systems, such as in Africa as well, are some of the most vulnerable and are also without the tools and resources to protect themselves. So this is only a growing problem. And then the second point I want to speak about is the more extreme weather. So increased air pollution actually is leading to higher rates of patients having asthma and cardiovascular disease. And this is just one clear example that springs to mind for me. I'm not sure if you knew, but inhalers themselves actually have quite a big impact on the carbon footprint. So the most commonly used inhaler in the UK, which is known as the Ventolin Evohaler, it has a carbon footprint of 28 kilograms per inhaler. So just to give that a little bit more context, that's equivalent of driving a 175-mile journey. So this is due to the aerosols of those inhalers. And interestingly, these types of inhalers made up 70% of UK inhaler sales in 2011, compared with fewer than half in other European countries. And Sweden, as an example, only purchased 10%. So maybe there is a question to be raised that do most patients need these types of inhalers prescribed? So healthcare institutions globally, they play a real key essential role in addressing climate change, and more than 190 institutions representing the interests of over 18,000 hospitals and health centres from 31 countries have now committed to the Paris Climate Change Agreement. So far together, they have committed to reducing emissions by 30 million metric tonnes. This is an amazing, great step, and it is really a step in the right direction and great to see such health organisations really pushing targets, such as the NHS leading the way with targets of becoming net zero by 2040. But we do need more healthcare and life science organisations to start acting and leading the way, or they'll soon find that they're left behind the curve. As said by the World Health Organisation, a rude planet cannot sustain human lives and good health.
So looking at this from a non-industry perspective, what wider impact and wider social issues are due to climate change? And John, kind of what are the consequences of these?
So I think Lauren touched on some of this in her previous response, but I would say it's generally accepted that climate change is a global challenge. And as such, we see the impact of it equally as widespread, both impacting on social, environmental and economic balances. The implications are not just physical. Taking Bangladesh, the floods are caused by both seawater rises and increased rainfall inland. And it has been estimated that by 2050, one in seven people will be displaced by these floods. Now, the rise in sea levels has been projected to be about 50 centimetres by this time. And at this level, Bangladesh may lose approximately 11% of its land, and up to 18 million people will have to migrate because of the sea level rises alone. Now, that's a mass migration in linked to climate change. This land is also used for farming, and so the knock-on effect will impact on food scarcity and also the wider economies within the countries, which will no doubt be felt wider than just Bangladesh alone. And I'm only also talking about the impact of one country alone at this point, whereas many others will be impacted at the same sorts of times. So we talked about a little bit about too much water, but the effect of water scarcity has the potential to cause significant social upheaval as well. UNICEF stated that by 2040, one in four children will be living in areas of extremely large water stress. Tensions over water ownership between countries and even US states has already arisen, causing upheaval and tensions that have flared into violence. And water, although arguably the most important, is not the only resource which will become scarce and cause tensions to rise. Lauren just mentioned about hunger and sort of food scarcity as well. The wider implications of these examples and similar climate change related impacts will also disrupt global supply chains, similar to what we've seen through the pandemic. So this is another reason why businesses are now opening up and taking actions, having experienced this element of disruption during the pandemic.
It kind of seems that there's a lack of conversation generally about maybe the real-time impact that maybe healthcare is having and how it's having in accordance with, you know, decarbonisation, sustainability and climate change. And taking that into consideration, a few claps at 8 p.m. doesn't really suffice when talking about the real-time impact that the healthcare industry are having. What would you say to this, Lauren?
So I believe there is recognition for the health impacts of pollution and environmental changes. However, I do feel that there is a less recognition for the environmental impacts of healthcare being provided and received. So as a globe, I believe we're pretty reactive when it comes to healthcare. We don't really focus enough on preventative care, and we don't always take into consideration the carbon footprint of reactive care as well. At the end of the day, healthcare is about saving and preserving life, which I agree, this should be the focus. However, I feel we don't always look at the impacts of how we treat patients and in turn damaging our planet. Inhalers was the classic example, which I mentioned earlier on. Healthcare needs to ensure that sustainability and decarbonisation are not at the bottom of the priority list or in the middle, but these topics really need to be considered for every single agenda item. The aim should be to deliver quality care that is net zero where possible. If sustainability and decarbonisation is not considered, then there will be an increased strain put on the healthcare industry and life sciences, with costs increasing, creating a potential limiting ability to offer quality care to everyone. And climate change costs will also continue to grow throughout the century, especially if global emissions are not reduced substantially.
So John, I'd be interested to know what other industries are doing in this space and if there are any best practices which could be implemented within the healthcare and life sciences industry.
Yeah, so at EQUAT, we work across many different industry types, but we've also been producing a research report into the sustainability reporting performance of the largest listed global companies for the past 11 years now. Now, this report is called Sustainability Performance Report, SRP. It's available online. But from this, we've been able to rank the companies based upon their public sustainability reporting and also identify the leaders within the indices which we've researched, as well as the trends across the different industries. Now, what we were seeing a few years ago was that the leaders were extremely robust in measuring their operational footprint. Now, by operational footprint, I mean scopes 1 and 2, or otherwise known as the main electricity and gas emissions of the business, those that are consumed actually by the business. Now, over time, other companies have caught up. And this has become a general entry-level component, as in companies are required to essentially calculate their carbon footprint through compliance legislation, et cetera. And now, in the latest SRP report, we've seen a huge uptick in the commitment to net zero. And of the 180 companies that we've reviewed across the FTSE 100, the Dow Jones 30, the Stoxx 50, two-thirds of those are actually adopting a net zero position. Another area where we've seen, as a result of the net zero engagements, is actually working with suppliers and their supply chain. So this is where companies have understood that actually a large proportion, I think up to seven times their scopes one and two emissions, are actually within their supply chain, their scope three emissions. And so what they've started to do is work with suppliers to improve the understanding of the emissions, to increase the accuracy of the actual carbon emissions themselves, and then also explore how they can reduce this. Now, linked to the emissions reduction side of things, there's also the setting of a science-based target, or an SBT. Now, this is a critical component of the net zero commitment, as it outlines the reduction pathway, basically the route a business must take in order to reach net zero by 2050 or a time earlier. And as I say that, it can be used to understand what is required in order to get there, but also what is required to be more ambitious. So it's a great tool for businesses to really understand whether what is required, what is that the actions that are required, and how big is the progress going to be needed in order to hit that sort of net zero position by 2050 or earlier. Now, globally, there has been a huge uptick in this commitment of the science-based targets, and we've seen it widespread across many industries. Another area that where we've seen an upward trend is the undertaking of climate scenario analysis assessments. Now, these allow businesses to run assessments of their operations, of their logistical supply chain, and understand the risks and potentially the opportunities associated with the different future warming scenarios. So looking at a scenario, a future scenario that in 20 years time, in 30 years time, that the temperature will have increased by a certain amount. And that we utilize some scenarios, some modeling associated that is provided through some organizations in order to understand what the levels of warming will impact in the climate. So therefore, if you have a logistical supply chain, you're able to see where that's coming from. And if there is an increase in, say, flooding or extreme weather events, then that risk can be identified. And then obviously work can be done to try and mitigate that. So I appreciate that you asked about industry specifics. However, net zero position is the ultimate aim and is the best practice position. And the components are generally the same across each of the industries, though I would say that some industries are more advanced than others.
Lauren, is there any advice that you would give to organisations looking to maybe reduce their carbon footprint?
Yeah, of course. So when it comes to healthcare and life sciences, there's a number of things I believe organisations can do. So organisations really need to adapt to climate change to support the health of a population over the coming decades. So this kind of looks at treating symptoms, so preventing and or reducing the negative impacts of health hazards where at all possible as they occur due to climate change. But it's also kind of looking at addressing the root cause, so tackling the factors that make individuals vulnerable to climate health hazards, including the social and economical determinants of health equity. So further suggestions as well could include using remote monitoring and virtual care, as this will support in the reduction of CO2 emissions, as patients don't need to then travel to and from hospitals or doctor surgeries and can have consultations taking place remotely, for example, through video conferencing. And another suggestion as well is investing in IT. So whilst digital technologies account for around 1.4% of global carbon emissions, they can also reduce carbon emissions by around 15% by 2030. So to me, investing in technology is really investing in sustainability, and I don't really see them being any separate. So let's face it, there's no country that wants to be locked into a future of increasing healthcare costs, increasing population illness and death because of climate change, which has a direct impact on health. I believe it's key for governing bodies to support implementing legislation, but also supporting to strengthen the healthcare systems and to support and address the root cause of vulnerabilities. And then the health risks and costs to climate change can hopefully be substantially reduced. I also think it's really key to remember that climate change is both a threat and an opportunity for already overstretched healthcare and life science organisations. By adopting a holistic and responsible approach to the management, by reducing emissions, protecting individuals' health, even before they need care, the whole of society will benefit. It is essential cornerstone financially, environmentally and socially to enable a sustainable tomorrow.
Lauren, so just to kind of close, why should we care about decarb if we will cease to exist in 100 years anyway?
So I think I'll take this because I do feel quite strongly about this element. Now, this topic and concern is not just for long-haired hippies anymore. It's really become mainstream. And hopefully the discussions that we've had today have really outlined the urgency in which we need to act. Now, scientists predicted the impact of climate change about 30 years ago, and it's taken this long for the world to get on the same page. In this time, the effects of climate change have become much more frequent due to rising temperatures, and we're likely to tip across the 1.5 degree threshold in the next decade, and as such, likely experience the scary points outlined in the IPCC report, some of which Lauren mentioned earlier, such as the significant loss of sea ice, dramatic sea level rises, frequent extreme weather events related to the temperature rises, but also the melting of glacier ice. All of this is happening much sooner than 100 years. So unless you're really on your way out, you will be impacted. Perhaps not directly, though the likelihood is it will, but indirect elements of your life, power outages caused by flooding, supply disruptions to your favourite products grown and flown in from far off regions, those regions impacted by climate change and therefore unable to provide those, and potential increased cost to the living as a result of the harder to procure products, as I just mentioned, but also the cost to replace and repair climate damaged infrastructure. And if that's not enough to care or take action, then some people might call it pretty selfish to leave this to others, especially our children or grandchildren, to live in such a damaged world.
Well, thank you so much, John and Lauren, for coming on the podcast. If someone wanted to learn more about this, how would they be able to do that?
Of course. So if anyone wants to learn anything more about these topics, please feel free to reach out to either John or myself. It's been a real pleasure to be able to speak on this podcast today. But we also do have some great resources on our EcoAct webpage and also our decarbonisation webpage on the Atos Healthcare and Life Sciences site. So please do have a little look there as well.
And that concludes our episode for today. So stay tuned for our next episode. And thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay tuned for more insights from Atos.